And we're live on the Virtual Real Estate Investing Podcast. How you doing, Frank?
Doing great, man. Happy Monday. Happy Monday.
Yeah, we're doing it, baby. We're doing it. We are into we're into Q4. In my opinion, we're like right at that point where if we get a deal under contract today or tomorrow, you know, maybe we close it by the end of the year. But the idea of closing a deal by the end of the year gets tougher and tougher unless you're just going to go all cash and buy at a discount. So that's where we are.
Yeah. And what does that mean for any potential buyers out there in real estate? If you do plan on closing a deal before the end of the year and it goes under contract today, you better hustle your ass off or give yourself more time. Because we locked up our first commercial deal this time last year, and getting it done before the end of the year was a challenge. So if I have hindsight, if you're doing stuff in November and December, give yourself more time. But anyway, what are we talking
about? Go ahead. Be careful. If a broker or seller's like, I want to close by the end of the year, because they are going to have absolutely unrealistic expectations. Like they will start saying that like middle of November, like we want to get it closed by the end of the year. And just remember between like December 15th and January 7th, banks are terrible,
terrible,
terrible. Like you will get nothing done.
For sure. And well, this is the situation you really want to avoid. It's like, hey, I got under contract in October and the seller's really adamant about closing before the end of the year. Maybe it's a 1031 situation, some tax reason.
Crazy conspiracy theorist. That's the only reason these people just get crazy.
Yeah, right. So, but the seller is adamant about it and your earnest money's hard in November and you're begging a bank to get their processes all done. That is probably the worst position in real estate to be in, is that position we're describing. So just avoid that if you can.
Yeah. It's really easy when you're eager trying to get your first couple of deals done to be like, yeah, let's close before the end of the year. Right now, if a broker's like, hey, here's a great deal, but you have to close before the end of the year, I'm like, okay, you know, how are we going to make sure this happens? Because we got to go.
I think it has to make sense as a cash deal. You're past like October 15th or 20th. Otherwise, you just have a built-in extension in the contract that, you know, maybe you have to give 10, 20, 30 grand more EMD, but just have it in there. Anyway, go. What's up?
Okay. All right. So topics today, we've been talking macroeconomics a lot. We've been talking specific deals. Today, we just pulled 10 questions that I think are pretty good and we should be able to jive about. We got 10 questions about real estate investing, about storage, and we're just going to go through. Maybe we hit them all. Maybe we only get through a couple, but generally, I think these are quicker kind of answers. We'll go back and forth with a little bit and we'll get to the end. So question number one, do you think about investments like a game?
I don't know if I think about them like a game. I think, I guess I do, right? I know that the common analogy is poker, and I think that's a good one, right? Because whenever you're putting money into the pot, it is a risk reward decision, right? Like, let's say you're a developer, you're a speculator, right? I guess I could see how that's kind of like, especially if it's really speculative, like making bets when you're on a flush draw or a straight draw, right? You're like, hey, maybe I have both draws, the 50% chance of me hitting, but if I hit it, it's almost a guarantee that I'm gonna have a max return on my investment, right? And then you have, you know, the two pair, right? You're like, I'll place a conservative bet, 80% chance I win, right? So I understand like that part of it. So I think, guess it's like poker, but it doesn't occur to me while I'm thinking about the investment. It sounds like you probably have a better answer to this question.
Well, I wrote the questions down, so I probably had a little bit more prep prep than you. But I look at it like a lot of people talk about investing like poker or maybe like chess or something like that. I think when I haven't played a ton of poker or a ton of chess, so maybe I think about it more like sports, right? But I don't know. I think generally my strategy is this: don't lose money, right? Like, is there a chance I'm going to lose? Then I don't want to play that game, right? And you know, I want to make sure, you know, I always have an edge, right? So like Warren Buffett talks about the margin of safety being like, you know, things outside your control or things you don't understand. So like, I think I'm going to win, and then a lot of things can go wrong and I still think we're going to win. That's kind of how I think about it.
Well, we're still young enough in our careers and we don't honestly have the wealth. If we, let's say a personal guarantee got called in on our properties, that would kick our ass, right? hey, Frank and John, you owe $1 million, right? Like, I'm making that up. That would really hurt. I don't think you can think about real estate investing in commercial real estate like poker unless you have enough money spread around that you can play multiple hands at the same time, right? Like, it's, yeah, if I have $1 billion, I can place that bet on that flush draw. But until you get to the point where you have a lot of net worth, you got to protect what you have. So I think I'm similar to you.
Yeah, I like that. So the baseball analogy is we're always trying to hit singles, right? Like, we want to create a business that hits singles. And we know if we try to hit singles all the time, sometimes we're going to hit doubles, triples, maybe a home run, maybe a couple home runs, whatever, right? But we're set up to hit singles. If, to your point, if we're maybe more mature in our career and we're playing with house money and all of our LPs knew, like, hey, there's only a 10% chance that this goes, but if it does go, like a big development deal, it's going to return 10x, right? Some people play that game. We just don't play that game.
Yeah. Well, that's just investing in general. People who have $50,000 to their name don't become angel investors, right? They probably put that 50 grand that they can invest in the stock market or something more liquid. So that's just investing, I think, in general.
For sure. And it's also this idea of like, Warren Buffett never changed, right? Like, no matter how rich he got, he just kept saying, hey, I want to maintain an edge. Hey, I want to maintain an edge. And if he could beat the market over and over and over again, right? But okay, enough about that. Question number two, what's the easiest thing about real estate investing?
Compared to other investing, probably the underwriting. If you're comparing it to other things, like, yeah, there's complexity and it can be challenging, but it's not complicated to fill out most operators' underwriting, you know, Excel doc when you compare it to probably what an investment banker does, right? So I think like calculating a cash on cash return, if you're a cash flow investor, is not a complicated process. You got to pull the rents, right? Find a building that's similar, pull the rents, take your price, take your interest rate, plug it in. And really that the unpredictability there is with operations past that point. Like the operations can be tricky and maximizing a asset can be hard. There's a lot of work that goes there, but I think underwriting relative to other asset classes is not difficult. What do you think?
I would agree that it's underwriting. I think all underwriting is pretty easy, depending on, you know, what you're trying to accomplish. I think lots of people try to overcomplicate underwriting, right? But yeah, I definitely agree, especially the way we do underwriting where we're going, hey, let's buy under market and get to market rates, right? So we don't try to predict the future a lot. I think the easiest thing about real estate investing, though, is generally people like it and want to invest in it, right? Unlike some things that are like, okay, let me, like, we've been on some pitches before where people talk about, you know, like short-term business lines of credit or how, you know, they're going to hedge this for that. And it's like, I still don't understand what they're talking about. And it's complicated where you're like, hey, we invest in real estate. People are like, oh, really? Tell me more. Right? Like, yeah, it's, you know, whether they invest or not, or they like it or not, whatever. But like, people understand that real estate, or they believe real estate's a good investment overall. So I'd say that's easiest.
That's also very true. Like we're West Point grads. We have decent pedigree, but we're not Harvard MBAs. Our GPAs in college are okay. Not great. Probably like slightly below average for West Point.
My undergrad was terrible.
Like, so, you know, from a pedigree perspective, we're okay, right? But if you're going to like be a short seller, like you probably got some people on your team that you're like, oh, this guy's qualified to short sell. Real estate, the threshold to be sophisticated enough to raise money is significantly lower. So I will certainly agree with you there.
Okay. Hardest thing about real estate investing?
Honestly, I think, there's a lot of bullshit on social media. So ignoring all the bullshit for me personally, right? Like there's a lot of people that are like, I won't buy a deal unless it hits the 2% rule. There's other people that are like, only invest in markets with increasing population. There's all these like people out there with all these rules and all this, these theses and all this shit. And there's so much flexing about this deal I bought in 2016 and now it's a home run in 2021 or 2022 after they pump stimulus in it. So it's really easy to get into the comparison game in real estate. And I think it's probably true in any asset class, but in real estate in particular, because technically every homeowner is in the game to a certain extent. So there's just a lot of people talking about it. So I think just ignoring the bullshit and trusting your own thesis has a little bit of challenge. And sometimes I'll like get envy about someone else's amazing deal they posted, or someone will post something about their investment thesis and it'll make me insecure about our thesis. And ultimately you got to look at your own results and judge them yourself and not ignore some of that shit. I think sometimes that bothers me.
I'll agree. It's tough. You want to know what other people are doing. You want to learn from them, but there's always people doing more deals and bigger deals and more successful deals. If you know enough people, that's just how the world works, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So you're just agreeing. There's no, what about another challenge? Let's pick up one then.
No, for sure. I've got more. I was just thinking, like reflecting, like one of those things I have to get better at. Right. So I think the hardest thing about real estate is making money in the short term. I think making money in the long term's easy. You get appreciation. If you can leverage appreciation, right? If, you know, generally real estate goes up 3%. Leveraged, let's call that, you know, let's call that 6 to 9, right? That's a good investment, right? Good investment. Do some cash out refis. So you have little equity in the deal. Now it's a great investment, right? In the short term, though, if you just look at cash flow, if you look at cash flow on a single family rental, well, cash flow on any asset is kind of similar, right? Like relative to its purchase price, where it might be a larger number, but proportionally, cash flow is tough to live off from, right? So trying to make money in the short term, I think, is the hardest thing.
Yeah. Well, it's, and then once you start making money in the short term, which in a lot of cases, that's going to come for commercial real estate in the place of fees, but on the multifamily or small multifamily and single family side, that generally looks like flipping or wholesaling deals. And it's really hard to stand up a wholesaling or flipping business and then have the discipline to hold some assets for yourself, right? Because you start investing in it, your systems cost money. If you have an employee, they cost money. So then you're like, oh, I got to pay for that. Now I have a new expense. So I need to flip this house instead of holding on to it. So like making short-term money and long-term money at the same time is, I think, actually is maybe really what we're saying. It's really hard to do both at the same time.
Yeah, for sure. Then the other thing I think is really hard is we don't have a crystal ball. So telling the future, right? What do I mean by that? I mean, there's clearly prices we can pay today that if the future is flat or even goes down some, like we'll be okay. But there's some deals or there's some prices where we'd like to pay because we think that that market is going to get better, but we don't know at what magnitude that market's going to get better. And that's also a bet that we don't like to make unless we have to, right? So just not understanding exactly what the future looks like is hard because there's some deals or, you know, let's say anyone investing in a major metropolitan or major MSA, right? Like anyone investing in a major MSA, like they are making a prediction about the future that may or may not be correct. And a little bit of that is scary.
For sure. I mean, it's a good answer because you're saying what's the hardest thing. I think that's really, really hard. And that's hence why we really haven't done it. Because if you are good at that, then that's where the real money is. But we're hitting base hits for now.
Okay. Next question. Next two questions. How have you evolved your thinking about hiring people? And then we'll go firing, but let's go hiring first. How have you evolved your thinking on hiring people?
I think we're a bootstrap company, right? Like so this is through that lens. We're not a venture capital. We haven't been infused with 10 million bucks. So we're kind of have to hire, you know, 10 to 20 people real quick to get revenue growing. That's not who we are. But we have gone through periods of rapid hiring in the past, primarily when we were wholesalers and flippers. And I think if you're a bootstrap company, I think you'd be really, really careful about over hiring, right? Like you just can't handle the inefficiency that might come with hiring 5 to 10 people within one quarter, right? So I think one thing I've learned is I like my personality type meshes well with being really deliberate with hiring persons, right? Like if me and you are bootstrapping this company and we don't have enough time to interview all the candidates that are coming into the company, that means we probably hire too much, right? Or being too aggressive. Like we should have the time to be very deliberate, vet everybody, generally get to know them. And I think that sounds really, really like common sense, But we went crazy in late 2020 and early 2021 with hiring. And I think we learned a little bit of a challenging lesson. Like, hey, if you don't have a year of their salaries saved in the bank account, the more deliberate you got to be. So I think that's a lesson I learned.
I like that. I'll go in a different direction and say, like, the best predictor of future performance is past performance, right? And I posted that on Twitter last week in a more controversial tone, but a lot of people disagree with that, right? A lot of people think, like, hey, if you're in a job that doesn't fit you, but then you get in a job that does fit you, your performance can exponentially increase. And I think it can, but if I'm hiring manager or an owner of a company, I'm looking at probabilities. And the probability is, if you were average in your last job, you're going to be average in the next job. And more, I think we've seen that play out, where people that were A players in their last job become A players in this job, and vice versa. This idea that someone that used to be average, you can put in the right conditions and they're going to become awesome. I think it can happen. But again, as a business owner, the probability is that it won't.
I think what you're referring to is like grit, right? People who have a lot of grit tend to force themselves to be adaptive, right? Like, hey, for whatever reason, I took a role that is new to me and it's outside my comfort zone. I go through a period of real serious discomfort until I feel like I've reached the level of performance that I am comfortable with. And a good employee is going to be comfortable with, like, I got to be in the top 20%. Of my field, or at least feel like I'm one of the best in the company, right? Like, so their status is so tied to being close to the top that if they don't achieve being close to the top, they're going to push their way through. Like, that's what you're describing. And I think that can go up or down in someone's life, but if it's not coinciding with like a change in their personal habits or some other change about that person, the odds that their grit is higher or up, I think, is really, really low. Like, you see someone that's like all of a sudden fucking lost 30 pounds and just waking up at 5 o'clock in the morning every day and reading, and they did not do that before. I'm like, okay, I could bet on that person, you know, having much higher grit right now. But if someone's like gained 20 pounds, is looking for work, and I ask them what they're up to and they give me some really weird answer, the odds of that person improving upon their past performance is extremely low. Right. So I 100% agree.
Yeah. That crushes some hearts when you say that, right? Because there's some people out there that are just hating their W-2 and they're like, if I became an entrepreneur, if I started working in real estate, I'd be awesome. And I'm just like,
no, you wouldn't.
No, you probably won't. Like, work, be awesome in what you're doing right now. And then maybe you'll be able to carry it over. But yeah, it's interesting. Sorry for my, like, I'm like contemplating this as I go, because it's like, it sounds, I think, Machiavellian to be like, you're either good or you're not. But I think it's true.
I mean, how many NFL players, like think about athletes, right? The most competitive industries. Like, how many times do you see someone have like two bad seasons in a row, switch teams, get cut, and then come back and have this great career, right? It doesn't happen that often. It's not because scouts and talent evaluators are really bad at their jobs. It's because it's just not the way the world works. Unfortunately, we live in a tough place.
Okay, how has your thinking evolved about firing people?
I'm going to steal, I think this is a quote from Nick Huber, but I think he said, hire fast and fire faster. I don't know if I want our philosophy in our company to be that aggressive, but I think this is kind of piggybacking off our previous point. I think if you have serious performance issues, give feedback over the first 3 to 6 months of hiring someone, and it's just not working out, I am, the more and more we do this, the more and more I think most of the time the right answer is to find an amicable way to move on from that relationship. Because one, it's not good for the owner to have bad employees, and it's bad for the team. Two, I think a lot of people, the employee, even if they're struggling, there's a tendency to stick around in the role, right? You're getting paid your salary. That's how you feed your family if you have kids and stuff, etc. But you're not really doing them any favors by allowing them to fester in a role that they're really struggling with. Like, professionally, that over the long haul may be holding them back. So I think, you know, cycling people out that aren't working out, I think you got to be aggressive there. And it's really hard to do that as a new business owner.
Yeah, I think I agree with everything. I have tried to, excuse my language, but just try to be a dick here, because I think I was way too soft before. And now, like, there could be a million reasons to justify it. And I try not to think about any of them. I'm like, either do the job or you're fired. People are like, what about training? Like, oh yeah, of course there's some implied training. There's some implied counseling. There's trying to make sure we're communicating effectively, trying to make sure, you know, we have the right person, the right role. But ultimately, if we've lost confidence in someone, like, enough thinking about it to fire this person and we will move on. And I think, you know, maybe this it's like, I think generally maybe I'm overly sensitive in this area. So I've had to put this mask on, but I feel like I got to put the mask on and just be like, when in doubt, I'm going to fire people. I don't care if they think I'm a dick. I don't care if they don't agree. Like, it's right. So for the business, we got to do it. And I think you and I are generally always going to be too slow to fire rather than too quick to fire. And knowing that that's our natural tendency, I think it's appropriate for us to kind of be tough like that.
Well, yeah. I mean, let's put it this way. We've generally been slow to fire people, but there's definitely been times where we were aware, like, people were like not working, right? like, hey, this person's not working. Like, they're not showing up. They didn't let us know they were going to miss today. And they're not here. And there's a lot of people that are listening to, not a lot of people listening to us, but there's some people who are probably listening to us thinking these guys are being really tough on this conversation. And they maybe have someone in their company that's like not even showing up for work, like not even doing the bare minimum. And they're like going through this in their head. And like, that's what we're saying. Like, that's the person you're like, you got to fire them right away. Like, that's who we're talking about. We're not talking about the person that's like, has one bad customer call and is like struggling a little bit and they're asking a lot of questions. That's not what we're talking about. Like, effort, performance, character issues, they got to go fast. That's what I think we're really saying.
Yeah. Yeah. I like it. Okay. Let's go to the next one. How have mentors or kind of like impressive people helped you, and where did you find said people? I know we've talked quite a bit about mentors, and we can both just say, like, we don't have a bunch of mentors. So let's just call them like peers that we found impressive, right? Like, how, because we talk about building our network. So if we want to build our network, like, how does that help us? How does being in contact with those types of people help us? And then where have you specifically found them?
A lot of them on Twitter. I mean, our business was born because of Twitter and people like Nick and some others. And, you know, there's storage, people on in that group or that community that I still talk to on a recurring basis. And it's helpful to see, like, hey, they had a really successful deal or a couple successful great deals. How did they operate it? How did they underwrite it? And you ask those questions. And, I think most importantly, it's proof that it's possible, right? Like, hey, the thing that we're trying to do is possible, and it's possible to make it extremely lucrative and enjoyable. And that might be like 80% of the value you get from some of your mentorship is just watching them actually make it all work. And it gives you confidence. And then like, if you're really lucky, you can get someone to share what challenges they had, or like, yeah, you know, I did 8 deals in the last 5 years and one of them didn't go well and we were able to recover from it like this. So then your fear of failure gets a little alleviated. So I think like getting that proof is really, really important.
I think you're spot on. I think we were looking for a network that would be like, oh, you're using this lender? You should actually use this lender and you can get it way cheaper. Or like, oh, you didn't know this secret about real estate? Let me share you this secret and then you'll have a competitive advantage. And sure, maybe that happens some, but I think it's exactly what you said. Like, just giving you confidence. And I think I'm a really, really confident person. Like, I believe in what I'm doing. But you can also look at our growth and say, there was a time where we were a little nervous to, you know, wholesale or flip a house for $100,000, right? Yeah. Then there was a time where we were a little nervous to do a $500,000 house. Then we were nervous to do $1 million storage facility and then a $5 million deal, right? And now I think both of us would be like, hey, no problem doing a $10 million deal. I think both of us are still nervous to do a $50 million deal, right? Like, you know, I don't think either one of us have the confidence that we could pull off a $50 million deal right now. But I think there'll be a time where we do have that confidence, right? And we've talked to people that have done $50 million deals or $100 million deals, or you know, indirectly listen to someone who did a $1 billion deal. Right. And I think just talking to people that have done those deals and being able to say like, yeah, I think I understand how they thought about this. I think, you know, we are as smart, as organized, as hardworking as them. Like, I think we can do this. Like, that is so much of it. And I'll just also agree. Twitter's been great. And then we're both kind of leaning into local real estate networks or real estate clubs, organizations that are helping as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I think also I'll add on, I think a valuable thing is, you know, we went to West Point, so it's somewhat common for like a 24-year-old grad to reach out and be like, hey, can I talk to you for 20 minutes? I want to get involved in real estate. And I generally try to take like almost all those calls. And I think, like they have the same exact fears that we had, like years ago. And I think, it also is helpful to like talk to them because it actually reminds you like of what can be done. And also to a certain extent, how far you've gone. So I think that's helpful too. So I'll just throw that out there. How about I ask you this one and you go first, because I feel like it's easier to go first because I get the low hanging fruit. So let's balance this out. Next question. How do you make tough decisions?
I think the first thing I do is try to decide why it's a tough decision, right? Like, is it a tough decision because the wrong answer could destroy our company? Is it a tough decision because it could hurt people's feelings? Is it a tough decision because I'm going to be very uncomfortable making the decision, right? Like trying to make sure I compartmentalize why it's a tough decision. And then like, let's say, okay, do we buy this facility or not? Right. If that's a tough decision, you know, from a personal perspective, I think I like walking and reflecting while I'm walking, right? Like boring answer, but that's very important to my process or my days to walk around and think about that stuff. Right. And then I think, for me, you and Adam, it's to debate it sometimes like emotionally or fiercely, right? And make sure that we red team, blue team it, right? Meaning we say like, what if this went wrong? What if this went wrong? What if this went wrong? And we've talked to some people about it, but I think, you know, we always say the day one of us is uncomfortable or too uncomfortable to say what's on our mind to the other partner is the day our business starts to go to shit, right? So let's say it's a tough decision that Frank, that you and I don't agree on. I think it's, you know, really trying to get our thoughts out there. And then what often happens is we get our thoughts out there and we end the conversation. And then we, you know, come back later that day or the next day and go, okay, I've reflected on this. I think I understand. Is this what you're saying? Is this what I'm saying? Okay. What do we agree? What do we disagree on? And then oftentimes it's like, okay, here's the point that we don't agree on, but I can see your perspective. You can see my perspective. Now let's try to decide, you know, the probability of success and failure there. Right. So it's kind of a meandering answer, but I think my big takeaways for tough decisions are one, really trying to understand what the decision and the consequences are, making sure that I reflect on it, and then making sure me, you, and Adam kick it around and debate it and have time and space to really go hard if we have to. What about you?
No, I like that answer. I think that's why you see so many businesses have, you know, two people in the ownership team, because you need someone to basically check your emotional biases, right? And the way that we do it is we argue. And when someone argues with you, you know, hopefully you can start using logic and you start being logical with your responses, and that like mitigates the damage of emotional bias of one person or both persons, right? So you just, it's like a man sharpens man, that people say. So I think that's really, really valuable. I think for me, to add on to that, the best advice I ever got with like making decisions or maybe just doing hard things was from our old performance coach, Jen. And she said, how to frame something in your head and you got to do something hard. It's like, well, what would the best real estate private equity owner do? Like, don't think about like, man, what do I have to do right now? Just ask yourself that question. What would the best person in your job do in this exact situation? And it's just a way to detach from the emotions of, you know, maybe you got to fire somebody, just to remove the emotions that you have towards that person. Cause maybe you love that person. Be like, fuck, I got to fire them. This is bad. They're bad for the company. You know, the best real estate investor or owner in the world, it fires them, right? If you have to. And that's a good way to frame it, instead of like, what is John supposed to do here? You know? So I think that's a good way to make tough decisions.
I wrote that down. That's great. I need to go back to that. I really like that lens.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually just thought of it again when you wrote this question down and sent it to me, and I was like, damn, I gotta do the same thing. That's great advice.
For sure. Okay. Question 8 and 9, if not storage, which asset class?
I've been saying this a lot, billboards, man. I don't know enough about billboards to be dangerous yet. I'm still learning about them, but I'm like, yo, you can buy things at like 10 caps, maybe better, on market, even though inventory is really low. It's hard to find one for sale. But that's a good indicator that people like owning them. So I think that's interesting. And I think, if you're the owner of the billboard, great. But even if you're leasing it, right, maybe there's a land lease and you lease the land from someone or rent the land from someone and you put the billboard down, you can make it so that the leases are like 25 years with a 25 year option on the back. So imagine how much cash flow you can generate, you know, 10, 15 years down the road when your rent is somewhat stable or maybe going up in very predictable increments, and you can hold on to that for like 25 to 50 years. So I think from a retirement perspective, very, very underrated cash flow business is billboards. Not as sexy as I think what you're going to pick, but I think there's attractiveness to that business to me.
Yeah, no, I like it. I think if you're a solopreneur, I think that's great. Or if you wanted to stay a small shop, not that you can't go super big, right? But I think generally that plays that. I think my thought, and we've debated this a bunch, right? Like, do we ever look at a different asset class? I look from a personal perspective of, am I better at storage? And I'm like, no, storage to me, storage is a asset class. But what I do is I find deals, underwrite deals. You know, I've involved in the funding, but ultimately I feel like I delegate the property management to Adam. Right. And I trust Adam. So that means, in my opinion, if I learned another asset class, I'm looking at like, hey, I want a third party manager or a third party in-house manager. Right. Mm-hmm. So I don't look at the property management. I know property management can be tough and everything's got its challenges. But so then I'm like, where do I think I can find deals? Number one, if I could pick any asset class, I'm going to a higher price point, right? Just because the smaller margins are bigger numbers. But I think multifamily is probably too sexy. Office, I think, is a tough asset class that'll still do well, but it's only going to do well. And I would only want to do in class A locations, which is going to be super competitive. So I think I'm going industrial, right? I think you could say motel, hotel, short-term rental stuff, but I think I'm industrial or maybe something like industrial.
Why?
I think price points can be good. Right. I think ultimately those guys that are doing it are looking at it very similar to us. They're playing a longer time horizon game. But what they're saying is, let's say it's a multi-tenant industrial. So let's say there's four spots that should each be renting for $100,000, but each spot is renting for, you know, an average of $60,000. And it's going to take, you know, 2 years to get half the people up to market rate and another 2 years to get the rest of the other two tenants up to market rate, right? Like, that's kind of the same game we're playing. It's just an extended timeline, right? But they're saying like, this is market rates. Market rates is, you know, 100K. They're charging 60K. As soon as we can increase prices, we're going to increase those prices. And then on a cap rate evaluation, it's going to increase the value there, right? So the property management is different. Obviously, the properties look different. Your due diligence checklist is going to be different. But from a syndication perspective, finding a good deal that's undervalued, that you can make a move on, the pitch that we give LPs, I think all of that is more similar than it is different.
Yeah. I like it. And like the end product itself, it's not really a commodity. Right. But it's closer to a commodity than a luxury multifamily building. Right. So I think that's kind of what you're saying too. Right. Like, it's like, hey, it's somewhat predictable, like a quality spot in an industrial facility. you generally know what it can rent at, you know, and for who the sure. customer base is, you know.
And if we're going to say storage is a commodity, and I think we do, then we got to say industrial is a commodity too. That doesn't mean that location still matters. Curb appeal still matters. Third-party management still matters, but there's part of it that's a commodity, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so if not real estate, what industry? This is the harder one, right? As much as we know about real estate, if we can't be in real estate, what would it be? And you can't just say a small business, right? Like everyone wants to say SMB, small, medium business. Can't say that, right? So what industry do you go to?
It's tough, man. I mean, I used to work a little bit in tech. But I worked in larger companies and I realized I hated large companies. So like the logical place for me to go, if I got to feed my family, is to like go back to working in tech, but try to find a really small like fintech company that's like maybe, you know, Series A or pre-Series A, and try to just join that scrappy team and try to make it the best company possible, right? So I think that's probably what I would do. Like you put a gun to my head, you're like, hey, you can't work anymore. But there's part of me that's like, I don't know if I really enjoyed like working in like that space at all. You know, that's part of the reason I ended up here. So I don't know, man. Like, I don't know. I think that's what I would do to pay the bills. But like what my passion would be, I have no idea. Like, I really don't know. What about you?
Yeah, I think to pay the bills, I would get a sales job somewhere, right? Try to get like high ticket sales. I think that would be, you know, if I couldn't be an entrepreneur right away, right? Like that's what would pay the bills, is going to get a sales job. And then I think, you know, my ideal business is to be some type of, you know, something in private equity, right? Whether it's, you know, obviously real estate stands out and we can't pick real estate, but, you know, helping take over other businesses, right? Helping to, maybe, not necessarily like investment banking, right? But like investment banking on a small scale, right? Like there's investment bankers that just work Tampa, right? And they don't call themselves investment bankers, but that's basically what they are, right? I think of a role like that, you know?
Yeah. I mean, working in private equity in general, I think is pretty awesome. Assuming that you're in, like, there's no toxic workplace environment. We have Chuck works in private equity now, our college teammate, and Mark moved from IB or investment banking to private equity. Never seen him happier from a professional standpoint. Same thing you would say for us. I think there's just something about finding deals and then pitching those deals and then trying to just make them work. Like it's just such like a, it seems like a very fair and just like very, I don't have to question the value being provided. It's like, hey, we hit our numbers, the value is there. So I just feel like that's a very fulfilling way to work. And most people I know that work in private equity are generally pretty happy. So I buy your answer. I buy it.
Okay. Last question. This is a question. I haven't listened to Bigger Pockets podcast in a while, but they used to kind of make this the last question they would ask. And there was a time, I think maybe 200 episodes that I listened to every episode of the Bigger Pockets podcast when I was looking for motivation to get started, to get going, right? And I'd always think about my answer to this question. So let's answer it. The question is, why do most people fail, give up, or never get started?
You go first.
Damn it.
I keep going first. I'm trying to level it out.
Okay. Why do people fail, give up, or never get started? And I think there's only one reason, is because they quit, right? There's only one reason people quit is because they don't believe they can win. And there's only one reason people don't believe they can win is they lose their growth mindset, right? Growth mindset is this idea that you can continue to get better, you know, through failure, being open to new ideas. A fixed mindset is, hey, I believe this, I'm not going to get better, it is what it is. Or, you know, like learned helplessness is another term people are associated with, right? But it's this idea of like, I don't want to work, I don't want to try, I don't want to keep going because it's not going to produce the results. That's the only reason why people quit, give up, or never get started. They don't think they can be successful. So that's why you've seen all this mindset stuff. And so much of the mindset stuff out there is absolute garbage, right? But the right mindset stuff is absolute key. And it's not my job to teach you what the stuff, the good stuff is and the bad stuff is. But making sure that you have the right mindset and you look at things effectively, that's where it all is.
I think you're correct regarding like, why do people fail? Because technically if you just keep going, you don't fail. Right. So I agree, but there's another part of the question, which is like, why don't people get started? Right. And I think you can have a growth mindset and still struggle to get started. Like I see people who take like, I'm talking to the person that takes courses constantly and they learn everything, but they never actually do it. Right. Like they're just constantly just stuck in like the education hamster wheel. And I think you have to have a growth mindset for sure. But I also think people got to be honest with themselves. And like, I think a lot of people treat education and how long they have to get deals done like an unlimited timeline. And in reality, you don't, right? Like if you're taking courses for like 2 years and you haven't done anything yet, there you might have a growth mindset, but I think you got to be like, hey, at some point, I need to pull this trigger and trust that it's going to work, right? And I think there's a balance there. So I think the challenge is having a growth mindset, but also being a little firm with yourself so you make sure you actually get started. So I'll just caveat it with that.
Yeah, I think to that point, part of me is like, yeah, these are the ways to overcome that. But the like maybe the dick in me is just like, just be an employee. Like if you can't do deals, you're a W-2 person. And if you want to be an entrepreneur, go do deals. If you can't do deals, be a W-2 employee. I don't have time for you. That sounds kind of mean, right? But I think it is. Like there's so many people out there that love the idea of being an entrepreneur. But guess what? Being an entrepreneur like is so scary and a lot of it really sucks. And you really have to have a lot of intestinal fortitude. If you're not ready for that, like don't fool yourself. Don't try to fool your family. Don't try to fool anyone else. Like go get a job in real estate somewhere.
Yeah. Nothing wrong with that. It's a good way to live. I agree. 100%.
For sure. All right. Good episode, man. I like it. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. It was good questions. And I'm just going to carry us out. See you guys next week. If you want to follow us on Twitter, my partner is @John Plumstead and I am @Frank Scat. See you guys next week. Peace.